balance.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The extraordinary Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa has brought to the fore the shrinking nature of our world. Rare diseases in far-flung places now have the capacity to be easily spread. Diseases like Ebola pose a particular problem due to the relatively long period between exposure and becoming infectious. Unsuspecting individuals could easily board an airplane, be here in hours, and bring the disease with them. And that is why U.S. hospitals are preparing to deal with the disease in very special ways. So today we're going to talk about protocols in place at healthcare systems throughout the country to deal with Ebola and other diseases that could pose a public health threat. But we're going to start with a conversation with Bruce Johnson, president of SIM USA. SIM is an international Christian mission organization with nearly 3,000 workers from over 50 countries serving in more than 65 nations. Two of their volunteers were recently evacuated from Africa for treatment in Atlanta after being exposed to Ebola while helping to care for others stricken with the disease. One of those workers, Nancy Wrightbowl, is from Charlotte. Bruce Johnson, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Mike. Thank you.
First of all, how are Nancy Wrightbowl and Dr. Kent Brantley this morning? Because he's also being treated in Atlanta. How are they doing?
Thank you. Yes, we're pleased, actually, with the progress, the continued progress of both Dr. Brantley and Nancy Wrightbowl. It's encouraging that we don't get direct medical reports, but just more the anecdotal things like David Wrightbowl was reunited with his wife on Sunday, and he wrote me and said how wonderful it was to look through this plate of glass and be able to again see his wife after being separated for weeks. He placed his hand on the glass. She placed her hand on the other side of the glass, and they prayed together, and just tears of joy being reunited.
Are they the first instances of Western medical people or missionaries being contracting this disease, or have there been others?
There was actually a priest that was serving in Western Africa, and from Spain, he contracted it. He was flown back to Spain. Unfortunately, he did not survive this disease. So, you know, Kent and Nancy aren't the first. What made them unique was they were the first that had Ebola that were brought into the United States.
And that raises a whole bunch of questions that people had initially. I'm not sure that people still have those questions, but just in case they do, why were they evacuated to this country? And given the fact that there is no cure for this disease, why did we feel that we could help them any better than they could be helped by the other medical professionals who were there to help the local population?
Good question. You know, the doctors, the SIM doctors who were attending to them in Liberia were doing an excellent job with what they had. They were keeping them hydrated. They were checking their vital signs, of course, praying with them. But as we looked at the situation, we realized that the medical facilities, particularly at Emory Hospital, just provided so many more things in terms of tests that weren't available to them in Liberia. Things like checking, you know, not only their blood levels, but how they were doing in hydration, particular chemicals in their hydration. So various tests, of course, the equipment, number of people that were able to care for them. Our two doctors were caring for Kent and Nancy, but they had been caring for other Ebola victims before that, and they were just frankly worn out because of all of what they were doing to fight this disease. So they, along with their families and SIM, and then Emory stepped forward and said, we would be glad to have them come, and we were able to arrange an evacuation, a kind of a one-of-a-kind aircraft to fly them into Atlanta.
Was there ever any question about the wisdom of evacuating them to the United States, or was it a no-brainer?
You know, one of the things was, how are they doing? Can they survive the flight? Will the flight take too much out of them? That was really the major concern. that their doctors and their spouses needed to interact on. But in terms of actually bringing them to the United States, that was a very collaborative effort with the CDC, Emory Hospital, high levels in the United States government, SIM, Samaritan's Purse. No one organization kind of could bring this together. It was very much a collaborative effort.
Could somebody have shut this down? I mean, did the government have to okay this? Because I believe this is the first time we have brought people knowingly into the country with the Ebola virus.
You know, it took those several bodies or organizations in order to work together to approve it. If there was not a hospital available that said, yes, this fits our calling, our charter of what we want to do, that would have shut it down. If the airplane wouldn't have been available. It's a one-of-a-kind aircraft, I understand. If that had not been available, that would have shut it down. So many things had to line up in order to make this possible.
There's a short description in the paper about what the doctors and health professionals and volunteers in that part of the world have to do to protect themselves from the people they're serving, and how exhausting it is, and they have to wear these protective head-to-toe suits in these impressively hot conditions, and they're working incredibly long hours every day under those conditions. I would think that after time in those conditions and those long hours and the fatigue that must set in, that it is easy to make a mistake. Is that what happened in the case of Dr. Brentley and Nancy Reitbol? Do we know how they contracted this? Because you have to touch the bodies of these people. You have to come in contact with their bodily fluids.
That's correct. No, there it has not been identified yet where that point of contact came for them. The suits are sealed, and so the protective suits, to us in the U.S., they look like hazmat suits, but they're specialized suits, they're sealed. Those really provide the protection for those the doctors, nurses that are going in to care for the patients. And so both we're looking at what are the protocols, where might that point of contact been, because that is actually helpful in order to help stop the spread, understanding how does it actually jump from one person to the other. We know it's bodily fluids, but what kind of precautions further need to be taken? You know, oftentimes a person that is exhibiting the symptoms may not mention it to anyone else. And yet they don't feel well, they don't mention it. It so happens they, you know, have fever, maybe have diarrhea, vomiting, or whatever, and they don't say anything to anyone. And then you end up, you know, someone touches them, like what is happening right now in Liberia.
So I would take it that because Dr. Brantley and Nancy Reitbol are there and they know the symptoms and they know the consequences of those symptoms, they were quick to come forward with their own symptoms?
Absolutely. In my reading, and I'm like the rest of the Charlotte area and the rest of the nation, what is Ebola? How is this spread? If you and I, Mike, were standing in the same room, you know, and one of us had Ebola, what is that like? So we had to really ramp up on that. They know the symptoms. The symptom is a fever. But looking at a person that might, you know, otherwise look healthy, if you don't check their temperature, you wouldn't necessarily know that. And so when they were constantly checking their temperature every 4 hours, when their temperature went up just 1 degree, that's when they said, I need to be isolated and then checked out for this.
Of course, a temperature can be an indication of a number of different things, not just Ebola, so it makes it very difficult, it would seem to me, to diagnose in the early stages. There was an article in the paper this morning that quoted an expert in this field saying that we're making much ado about nothing here, that there's nothing to worry about in this country with regard to Ebola. I'm not sure that I completely believe him, but the way he lays it out in the newspaper this morning is that we will never come in contact with this, and we know how to take care of it when if we were to come in contact with it. But then there are people who are worried about the fact that Nancy Reichbold and Dr. Kent Brantley were brought back to this country with active cases. And then we have, I think, almost a dozen people in quarantine on your campus waiting out the 21-day waiting period to see if they are, in fact, infected. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, I
because
think,
they're not in prison. I mean, they're
that's right.
They can get up and walk around.
Yeah, Dr. Stephen Keener, the medical director for Mecklenburg County, has been so helpful to us in SIM, and so the county health department is really monitoring the situation with us. Quarantine is actually for healthy people. And so all of the people that are on our campus right now that return from Liberia that are under quarantine are healthy. They're doing well. The health department monitors them. It's the situation in Liberia where there is no, for practical purposes, a medical infrastructure like we have in the United States. Think of the Charlotte metro area. Let's say 1.5 million. The equivalent would be if we only had 20 doctors in Charlotte for all of the Charlotte region people. Mike, you may have a better figure, but I'm thinking 1.5 million. Can you imagine only 20 doctors and all of the hospitals have closed down except one?
Mm-hmm. Well,
and people started to get Ebola. People would go, we don't understand what this is, fear sets in, and so forth. So we have a much different situation in the U.S.
And that same article in the paper mentioned that in that part of the world, there's one doctor per 100,000 people, which is slim pickings. I mentioned at the very top of this that your organization, SIM USA, has nearly 3,000 workers from over 50 countries working in 65 nations. Has the fact that two of your volunteer workers, the fact that they've come down with Ebola, hurt your efforts either in terms of recruiting new volunteers or keeping those that you have willing and able to go and do their jobs in these other parts of the world?
You know, what amazed me, Mike, is when Nancy Reichbold and Kent Brantley tested positive, and word got out in our mission that that was the case. Nurses and doctors called and said, on our staff, called us and said, I'm ready to go, send me in.
Wow.
I just stood there with my mouth open going, wow, what level of commitment, what calling that they have. Now, they realize that they would be going into this situation, but it's that sense of calling to help the marginalized, to be able to go in, and they would be prepared. They would have the appropriate protective gear and so forth. But it's that kind of spirit that really has characterized SIM over its 120-year history, and couldn't have made me more proud of the medical professionals in our ministry that have said, here I am, send me in.
Bruce Johnson is president of SIM USA. They are the organization over there on the front lines of the Ebola outbreak. Two of their workers obviously been evacuated to the United States for treatment, and we wish them the best. And thank you for joining us this hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
When we come back, we will speak to the aforementioned Dr. Stephen Keener and others about healthcare precautions in this country. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Southern Ideal Home Show, cooking demonstrations, decorating vignettes, a water skiing squirrel, and the Nary Parade of Play Homes, Friday through Sunday, the Park Expo and Conference Center, southernidealhomeshow.com, and Healthy Home Market, a locally grown natural food store with locations in Davidson, Matthews, Independence Boulevard, and a new location coming to Plaza Midwood in mid-September, healthyhomemkt.com. Well, the legislature legislative session, the short session, seemed to go on forever, but it is finally over, and so a panel of political experts will talk about the marathon legislative short session of the North Carolina General Assembly and talk about what lawmakers accomplished, what was left on the table, and what we can expect from lawmakers in Raleigh moving forward. That's all tomorrow at 9 with guest host Michael Bitzer. Join him then.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, with the help of U.S. bombers, Kurdish troops are gaining ground in the battle against Islamist militants in northern Iraq. The expanded U.S. military role in the fight against ISIS in Iraq.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We'll spend the rest of the hour examining protocols in place in hospitals and communities around the country to handle a possible outbreak of Ebola virus or other infectious diseases in ways that provide adequate care for patients while protecting the medical personnel serving them. Megan Davies, MD, is Epidemiology Section Chief at North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services. She joins us for the rest of the hour by phone, I believe, from Raleigh. Dr. Davies, welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Stephen Keener is Medical Director for the Mecklenburg County Health Department. Dr. Keener is serving as the lead for that department in assisting, as you heard Bruce Johnson say, to help with SIM USA-sponsored missionaries returning to the U.S. from West Africa. Thank you for coming back. Good to see you. And Kevin Staley is Deputy Director of Medic. As such, he is responsible for all clinical care provided by county EMTs and paramedics, as well as being responsible for the agency's emergency management and homeland security functions. Thank you for being here as well.
Good morning.
Bruce Johnson asked an interesting question that he didn't answer, because he said when his volunteers first came down with this disease, he had to ask himself, like every other American, what is Ebola? Let's get an answer to that. I know it's a virus, but what is it exactly? Dr. Davies, do you want to take that? Or?
Yes, certainly. I'm happy to, and I'm sure Dr. Keener can add in if I omit anything. Ebola infection is a viral infection that is spread through direct contact with blood or body fluids. The virus invades various cells in your body and interrupts with those cell functions. So typically, the symptoms that start are sort of the famous flu-like symptoms that a lot of illnesses start with: fever, headache, muscle aches, generalized feeling of being sick that can go on for a few days. Often, patients will develop diarrhea, and then farther into the illness, their ability to clot blood in the right way gets affected, and you get a combination of your blood clotting in small vessels, which further damages your organs, and your inability to stop bleeding in the normal ways that our bodies do all the time. And so people will start bleeding. They'll have bloody diarrhea. They'll have coughing up blood, and generally they develop shock, which is the loss of fluid volume. There's no medication that actually cures Ebola at this time, but with good supportive care, which means good fluid replacement and making sure people are getting some nutrition throughout their illness, people certainly can survive it.
What is it about viruses, Dr. Keener? They come in, they infect the host, and in this case, this is a non-curable disease up until this point, at least. Most people die from it. What's in it for the virus to invade a host and kill it? Because the virus will then die with the host.
Well, viruses are not smart. Really, they don't have brains. They are incredibly small infectious particles, which by nature of their existence must infect and inhabit living cells. And that's the reason why conventional antibacterial agents don't work against them, because those antibiotics work outside the cell, not inside the cell. So what the virus does is it infects cells. It actually hijacks the cellular mechanism to reproduce and turns it into a virus particle factory and makes it manufacture, replicate many, many copies of itself. And it must, in order to survive, actually have a mechanism to be spread to other hosts. Now, like a lot of viruses that infect humans, this particular virus is also infectious in animals. And it is believed that certain species of bats in Africa are the kind of the reservoir for this virus. And from bats spread to other animals, and from those animals to humans, and then from human to human.
I already read yesterday, that bats are considered a delicacy in that part of the world. Could it be possible that this is being passed from bats directly to humans through consumption?
I have not heard that. I don't know, but bats certainly do have contact with humans. It's I wouldn't think it would be desired, but even in this country, you know, bats carry certain diseases, rabies being one of them, and contact with bats can spread rabies to animals or even humans.
I mentioned with Bruce Johnson, and there were there was a lot of talk about when Dr. Brantley was evacuated to the United States along with Nancy Reitbold, that there was a lot of concern and about the wisdom of such a move. And now we've read in recent days, including this morning in the paper, that there was no reason for any concern about this because we know how to handle these things. Was there cause for concern, Dr. Davies? And if not, why not?
No, I don't think there really was any cause for concern in bringing those two people back to the United States for treatment. And the reason is that we have very good standard infection control practices in the United States. So in this case, two people were returning with a diagnosis of Ebola, and there were precautions taken over and above what is probably truly necessary. But even if someone were to develop Ebola, become infected with Ebola, and present in an American hospital or medical center without the diagnosis already known, we standardly take infection control precautions in the United States that are not used in many developing nations.
And in many cases, Medic is on the front line of that. Kevin Staley is with us. He's the deputy director of Medic locally, and you guys respond to emergency situations, and you don't know what's on the other end of that emergency when you arrive. So how do you know? If you're called to somebody's house who is exhibiting a fever or diarrhea or whatever, and they're dehydrated and they need to go to the hospital, and so they call you, how do you know it's not Ebola, and what precautions do you take to get there and to take care of those people once your people arrive on the scene?
Well, I think you've already heard that the key is the universal precautions. In EMS, we follow those same strict protocols because we don't know. Information is the key. Facts and science are so important to this. And in the field, we often don't have those details.
But you don't walk into a house in hazmat suits.
No, but we also get a lot of information, for example, from 911. We're going in with some information in terms of what the signs and symptoms are. And we also sometimes will get that somebody's ill with the flu or they have some particular medical illness that we need to protect ourselves from. Keep in mind, when we talk about spreading through droplet contact, that direct contact with body fluids, we have to be protected from things like HIV in the community every day, hepatitis every day. Folks that are suffering from that also have other medical emergencies, are involved in car accidents, they bleed. So we do have that protective gear that we can put on and keep our folks safe.
HIV is passed through transmission of blood or coming in contact with infected blood. Is there a substantial difference in the way you would handle an HIV patient who might be bleeding profusely because of an accident of some sort versus an Ebola victim who is bleeding because of the virus?
Again, it's the threat is the body fluid. So whether it's Ebola or whether it's HIV or hepatitis, we have to protect. And we use the same gear. And the beauty of it is it's the same protocol. We don't have to invent something different. We're trained on it regularly. We do it regularly. So whether it's one virus or the other, it doesn't matter. We have the same universal approach.
Dr. Keener, you've been working with the people at SIM USA. They brought in almost a dozen volunteers who are in quarantine right now, and I'm told that you helped set up that situation. They're sitting at the SIM campus in RVs and keeping a 3-foot distance from each other, and thus far none of them have exhibited any signs. But what did you have to do to facilitate all of this?
So let me clear up what you said. There were only three returning missionaries who were placed under quarantine when they arrived, and they actually came in two groups. And the first group had not had any contact to Ebola that was identified. They were completely asymptomatic.
How do we know that? How do we know they had no contact?
Well, I think that it would behoove anybody who had been in contact to certainly report their symptoms, but these were individuals that were not healthcare workers, and they were in many respects they were children, and they were not around where any Ebola care was going on.
Okay.
And the missionaries and SIM as an organization have been extremely cooperative and have gone beyond what is desired or required on our part to make sure that their folks are safe and that they have assured us so that we can reassure the public.
This cannot be transmitted through the air. So if somebody sneezes or coughs or breathes in your direction, you're not going to necessarily get it. But it is in body fluid. So if you sneeze or cough, it seems to me, there are sometimes droplets that are expelled from the body. Could you get it from that?
Well, you know, that was a question that was asked Dr. Frieden in Washington, and the way he responded was that we know that this disease is spread through direct contact from person to person. It is not like tuberculosis, which is spread through the air through the respiratory route. So as a practical matter, This is spread by direct contact, and the type of precaution that's used is standard contact and droplet contact, not respiratory.
And at what point, and I'm not sure which of the doctors to ask this, but either one of you can chime in, at what point do you become contagious?
When you're symptomatic, when you have fever and symptoms.
So if you are a person who has been exposed through, not necessarily through touching the people that are in quarantine who may or may not have come in contact directly with the Ebola virus, who are not exhibiting any symptoms whatsoever, they are healthy individuals, but they're just in quarantine for their protection and ours, they are not infectious at the moment, even if they come down with it later on?
Yeah, that is
correct.
And I think this is a good time to make real clear to the listeners the difference between quarantine and isolation, because they're two different things, even though they're often used interchangeably. Isolation is when the movement and activity of a person who is infected is limited, someone who actually has disease. Quarantine is the restriction of movement or activity of a person who is well but who has been exposed to a disease. And the reason why we do that is to make sure that that person doesn't develop symptoms. Mm-hmm. And because they did and they weren't in a controlled situation, then it would be possible for other people to get infected from them.
So the people that are in quarantine now who are not exhibiting any symptoms, let me be clear about that. If one of them were to start exhibiting symptoms, what would that mean for the others?
Well,
because they're in there together, aren't they?
Sure. Just because somebody, first of all, just because somebody starts developing symptoms, that doesn't mean that they have Ebola.
Okay.
Because as you pointed out, there are plenty of things that can cause a fever and general body aches and fatigue.
And diarrhea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And most of them, quite frankly, are not Ebola.
Yeah.
So the first thing to do would be to probably separate that person just to be on the safe side, but at the same time, go about a full evaluation to to try and make a diagnosis or exclude a diagnosis.
We have heard about this disease over there in Africa for years, and it comes and it goes. But this one has been declared by the World Health Organization as a public health emergency of international concern. Dr. Davies, why? What is the difference with this outbreak and all of the previous ones?
Yeah, that's a question I appreciate you asking, because I want to make it very clear that the difference in this Ebola outbreak is related to the societal issues, not to the virus itself. The virus itself has not changed, and they've sequenced it, compared it to other viruses, and it is Ebola virus Zaire, and it has not changed. So it's still transmitted the same way. It causes the same clinical syndrome. The difference is that it's occurring in an area where there's a fair amount of movement across borders, where there's a history of civil wars and civil unrest in the past decade or so that's undermined the infrastructure of that region. And that allowed the outbreak to flourish and get out of control. And now that it has global attention, I think many more resources will go into that area, and probably I'm optimistic that over the next few months the outbreak will be controlled. It's going to be a lot of hard work and effort, but I think over the next few months it will start to come under control.
You have said, Dr. Davies, that casual contact, and I think this has been said by others on this program today too, but the casual contact with someone infected with Ebola does not put other people at risk for contracting the virus. So why put asymptomatic people in quarantine?
Yeah, so the essence of quarantine is the ability to monitor for the development of symptoms. And we only restrict movement or activity to the extent we need to be assured that we are monitoring for any development of symptoms in a timely enough way. So staff working with Dr. Keener are calling twice a day to talk to the people who are under quarantine orders to assess their symptoms and talk them through it. That gives us the opportunity to quickly move someone from quarantine into truly an isolation while they're being evaluated. So the first thing that we do when we hear from someone that they have a fever or they're starting to feel sick is say, we want you to go into a room with its own bathroom and just stay away from your family for a while, and we're going to keep calling you and talking to you, but don't interact with anyone now because you might be starting your symptoms. And then we set up whatever medical evaluation is necessary. So quarantine is, I think, the image of just sort of telling someone, don't move, stay where you are, we'll let you out in 21 days is completely wrong. It's really about close communication, monitoring for the development of symptoms, and planning. So we go over with people what they're going to do the minute they start to have a headache or any symptom they think might be the beginning of the Ebola symptom complex.
I think this is particularly scary to lay people who don't understand medical protocols, because we see the need for hazmat suits to be worn by the healthcare professionals who are treating and coming into contact with people who have Ebola. Are there any other diseases that require those kinds of precautions in the Western world?
Mike, I'd like to just
We have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, one thing about the hazmat suits, it's actually not necessary to wear a hazmat suit to treat an Ebola patient. That's done in Africa because the circumstances are not as well controlled as in the United States. And with our first two patients coming back, I think everybody has approached it with an abundance of caution, and that's appropriate. But you don't need a hazmat suit to be safe treating an Ebola patient. You just need an impermeable cover and a face mask.
And with that, we have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bilo Supermarkets, serving the Southeast for over 50 years. Bilo offers bonus fuel perks items with the Bilo Bonus Card. Store locator, weekly ad, and fuel perks. Program details at buy.com. bombers-low.com. With the help of U.S. bombers, Kurdish troops are gaining ground in the battle against Islamist militants in northern Iraq. So Diane Rehm and her guests will be talking about what's going on over there, discussing the expanded U.S. military role in the fight against ISIS in Iraq, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about, well, Ebola, now's the time. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
I'm Silvia Poggioli. You probably imagine me cruising around Roma in a Ferrari convertible. Ha! Try a 2006 Toyota Corolla with a missing side view mirror. Whatever you drive, when it's time to part with it, donate it to us. You'll get a tax break and we'll tow it away for free. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Donate your car through Car Talk's vehicle donation program. Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Ebola this hour and the precautions that American hospitals and healthcare facilities already have in place to take care of that and other infectious diseases with Dr. Megan Davies, MD, who is Epidemiology Section Chief for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Stephen Keener, MD, is a medical director for the Mecklenburg County Health Department. He's been working with SIM USA in setting up the quarantine for their volunteers who have come back from West Africa. And Kevin Staley is with us. He's the deputy director of Medic locally. Dr. Davies just said that you do not need these extraordinary hazmat suit protections to care for Ebola virus victims, that they're used in Africa because of other problems in the healthcare system that we don't have in this country. Are we particularly well-equipped? Are you convinced, Dr. Keener, that in Charlotte, if somebody presented with this or some other rare disease that requires these kinds of precautions, that we would automatically have the ability in any hospital, large or small, in Charlotte or way out in the country someplace, to handle something like
that? Well, here in Charlotte, we have state-of-the-art medical care with our healthcare systems, and we have state-of-the-art pre-hospital care with our Medic EMS system. And, you know, as Dr. Davies has pointed out, you know, with the care of Ebola patients, what is needed is standard precautions, contact precautions, and droplet precautions. All of our medical personnel are well equipped to do those things. We have the proper equipment and training, and so the answer to the question is yes.
There was a gentleman who presented with fever and other symptoms of Ebola in New York after getting off an airplane, and he was admitted to Cedars-Sinai Hospital. Later on, it was determined that he did not have Ebola, but there was a story in the media about it, obviously, and there were photographs of that area of the hospital being cordoned off with police tape. Was that a ridiculous precaution? I mean, obviously it made for a good media moment. Were we irresponsible in covering it?
I am not familiar with the circumstances. I was vaguely aware of the story in the media, but I'm not familiar with the facts, so I don't think I can comment on it.
Nancy Whitehall, Whitebowl rather, from Charlotte, was sent to Emory University Hospital for treatment when she came back from Western Africa. She is from Charlotte. Why was she not sent here?
I think that's probably a better question for Dr. Davies.
Dr. Davies?
Yes, so I obviously wasn't part of that discussion, but these were the first Ebola patients coming to the United States for treatment. I think there was a lot of concern for public impression and whether people would feel safe. And indeed, you know, that was a justified concern because there were people who actually said publicly they didn't think it was appropriate to bring these people, these American doctors and healthcare workers home for treatment. But I think a decision was made to use one of the high-level isolation facilities that exist in the United States. There are four hospitals with them. Emory is one. University of Nebraska, I believe, is another, and there are two others somewhere in the United States that have these very high-level isolation facilities that were built with federal money for bringing home people with diseases for which what we call emerging infectious diseases that we don't have a great deal of knowledge about. Ebola, we have a lot of knowledge about. We know how it's transmitted, but I think it was, again, an abundance of caution and to reassure the public that it was safe to bring these good people home for treatment.
Well, I want to get back to something you said about the hazmat suits, that they're not necessary to do this, and that they do it in West Africa because of conditions in their healthcare facilities that are not as up to par as ours are. There's an article in the New York Times in which the CDC said that healthcare workers, they agree with you, that healthcare workers treating Ebola patients need only wear gloves, a fluid-resistant gown, eye protection, and a face mask to prevent becoming infected. But there were other hospital officials quoted in that story who were skeptical of that. Is there not agreement across the medical field about what's necessary?
Oh, I think there's agreement about how the disease is transmitted and what is necessary to prevent transmission of a blood and body fluid transmitted disease. I think that the concern is the high fatality rate with Ebola that makes people think that they want to take even more precautions. It's not exactly logical, but it's completely understandable. And also the need to reassure your healthcare workers who are receiving these patients that they can give the best quality care and spend as much time as necessary with the patient without endangering themselves. So we sometimes do more than is proven scientifically as necessary in order to deal with the human element of this. You don't want your nurses and doctors and respiratory therapists who are treating the patient to be severely anxious for the whole time. You want them to feel comfortable and be able to focus on patient care. So we go a little beyond.
It is said that North Carolina has a multifaceted preparedness infrastructure involving multiple agencies to deal with disease outbreaks. And I guess it begins with you on the front lines in many cases. How does that infrastructure work? What's the process?
Well, I think what you see, that's not unlike other places in the country, but particularly here in Charlotte, there is such a close working relationship between the hospitals, the public health department, EMS, and then our partners at the state with the CDC. So for us, one of our concerns is at the airport. So if somebody, you pick the disease, comes from another part of the world, is sick, and then arrives in our airport, that's introducing something that we may not have in this community. So it's working closely, for example, with the CDC and public health to monitor for that. And we've done that routinely. MERS, most recently, the information went out about the respiratory syndrome and what we need to do to look out for that and how to protect ourselves. I think another comment, too, I think the visible thing that everyone's seen in the media was the transportation of Nancy and Dr. Brantley to the hospital. And so you saw that EMS component and you saw
it's
the folks.
Extraordinary.
Very much so. And so I think there's the visual is conflicting with the message that's being given, but also keep in mind that the setting is very different.
Well, let's talk about that because we were just told you don't need all these extraordinary precautions to deal with these people. And yet Nancy and Dr. Brantley. Thank you. Dr. Brantley were escorted in this specially constructed airplane in a essentially a cocoon, sealed cocoon, and then they were brought into the hospital on stretchers that way with EMS people right. in hazmat suits. If it's not necessary and you know it's going to be on television, why do that?
So I think when you're in a hospital, you have a very controlled environment. When you're in an aircraft or in your back of an ambulance, and you have people that potentially could become sick. They could start vomiting. Mm-hmm. That's that direct fluid contact we're talking about. You're talking about a very small, confined space. So that extra level of precaution for us, because we're in a confined space, makes it safer for the medics and the personnel on board the aircraft to function because you don't have the large open area of a treatment room or a medical center. And that's really – if something happens, that's not the time to stop and now put all your gear on. You're able to take care of the patient, provide that outstanding care.
And if we're ready and we have these protocols in place, why is there, once again, an article in the New York Times that says, and I quote, hospitals nationwide are hustling to prepare for the first traveler from West Africa who arrives in the emergency room with symptoms of infection with the Ebola virus. If we're ready, why are precautions being taken?
I think I'll let Dr. Keene weigh in, but from the pre-hospital standpoint, it's something that's new and it's education. It's exactly what you're doing and others are doing right now, putting the facts and the science out there. It's a scary thing. And to get that information, we have the equipment and to reassure people so they can do their jobs effectively.
I would answer that question by saying there is no ready. There's only more ready. Mm-hmm. And even though you've been trained and even though you know what to do, it's important to drill,
and
practice,
be reminded.
It's just like It's just like football teams. Even though they play a good game, that doesn't mean they don't practice during the week. So it's really important to continue to drill, continue to practice, and like I said, there's only more ready.
I mean, we have very good hospitals in this part of the world, in this part of the state, and I'm sure there are other places in North Carolina that have excellent hospital facilities as well. But there are also small towns whose hospital is very small and may not have the resources of a Carolina's medical system or Novant Health. Are they prepared?
I can't answer the question.
Okay, Dr. Davies?
Yes, and in the same way that Kevin has stressed, they are prepared because they routinely take care of people with infectious conditions, whether it's tuberculosis or HIV or hepatitis. And everybody, if you've ever had to go for medical care to an urgent care center or a hospital emergency department, everybody who interacts with you is at least wearing gloves. That's just what they start with. And they look at you and assess your symptoms. If you're coughing a lot, they'll either put a mask on you or a mask on themselves. And then if you're throwing up or bleeding, they'll put on an impermeable gown or apron. It's a standard thing that everybody's trained in.
As you're talking about this, it recurs to me that in the 1950s and 60s, that was not the course of action. I remember my physician, my pediatrician, handling me with bare hands, always. When did we start wearing rubber gloves for everything and having impermeable suits around?
In the 1980s.
What took us so long?
Well, I think we started that practice with the HIV epidemic. And even though now if an HIV patient comes into an emergency room or is transported by ambulance, if that patient's on their medications, they probably don't have any virus in their blood and they're probably completely non-infectious. Mm-hmm. But it's a very good practice that we adopted early in the HIV epidemic that I think is serving us very well when dealing with other pathogens.
I suppose it does not help the public who doesn't know as much about this as the three of you do to understand that the first person ever to be evacuated to the United States with Ebola was a medical doctor who knew what he was up against in West Africa, took all the precautions that we know how to take, and still contracted the virus. From a medical professional's point of view and from the frontline point of view, how does that make other medical professionals feel when they're not up on this every day because they don't deal with it every day? And the first person to come back is a doctor who was.
I think it's the context of the environment and the conditions. This is a modern medical infrastructure in the United States and certainly what we have here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. So it's, again, that education and providing the context. They still don't know how he got it, but we certainly know that we have a much higher medical infrastructure here to prevent that sort of thing from occurring.
Will we ever know how he contracted it?
The CDC is doing an extensive epi investigation of that, and that's their role as the federal agency since this occurred internationally, and they're working interviewing people and doing observations to try to determine what the possible means of infection could have been in both cases. And at some point, when they have enough information that they feel that they can make a determination, they will share that. But I know that they are investigating that.
Dennis in Lake Norman writes, "Do your guests think the media is helping stoke the fears many are expressing about bringing the two patients to the U.S.? And Donald Trump's comments certainly didn't help. He had some unflattering things to say. Are we fanning the flames unnecessarily, or are we informing the public and allaying fears?"
Well, I'll speak for our situation locally. I think the media has been much more of a help than a fearmonger. The media is very important in getting information to folks, and that's why we try to work cooperatively with the media, because then we can get the right information, the correct information to the public. And I think in our experience, it's when we don't talk that people's anxieties raise.
Are there ways to ask questions of you that would be less fear-mongering?
Well, I'm sure there are, and I wouldn't And I wouldn't say that, you know, there aren't some media outlets or reporters who try to, you know, address those kind of ticklish areas, like when the visual appearance doesn't match the message that you hear.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's been here in Mecklenburg County. I think it's been responsible reporting, and we have no problem with it.
Bill from Matthews writes that I heard it on NPR this morning, so it must be true, that a musical group from Liberia has recorded an Ebola song that contains the lyrics, "Don't eat the monkey meat, don't eat the baboon meat." It seems to be a familiar refrain that harkens back to the onset of the AIDS epidemic. Might there be some connection? Is there any evidence to support that either that Ebola might be a result of ingesting simians or possibly caused through sexual contact?
So that's an interesting question. It really hasn't been determined how that initial case happens in any given Ebola outbreak, how you get the transmission from an animal to the first human case. Once you've got a human case, it's human-to-human transmission from body fluids and blood. But whether it's eating bush meat, which is what that song refers to, or whether it's a fruit bat contaminating something else that somebody might eat, or some other way, that hasn't been determined, and our focus when these outbreaks happen is always on stopping human-to-human transmission, and that so far has always ended the outbreak. So it's not actually known for sure what the initial exposure might be.
I have 30 seconds left, and these folks in quarantine are there for 21 days. What is magical about the number 21?
21 represents the longest known possible incubation period for Ebola virus disease. So presumably if someone passes 21 days, they haven't got sick, they don't have infection.
Dr. Stephen Keener, MD, is Medical Director of the Mecklenburg County Health Department. Dr. Megan Davies, MD, is Epidemiology Section Chief for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. And Kevin Staley is Deputy Director of Medic, the people on the front lines of bringing people to health care facilities. Thank you all for joining us this hour.
Charlotte?